Chapter 5. You could hear the circus from 20 streets away and see it from 10. The horns, the sirens, the deafening come-ons from tannoys, the dancing light beams and the popping flares. It lit the city night of Formal G like a bowl of fire. The approach streets and ramps were packed, jostling multitudes, laughing and drinking, and the peddlers, tricksters, hawkers and smile girls who fed off them. It was a game night. The circus drome was a colossal domed amphitheatre, its tiered and arcuated outer walls towering 90 meters high. But the great ooze-like substance of it was just a shadow in the smoky night, lost behind the flash and dazzle of the raging light show. Red stab lights on the tops of the walls criss-crossed the exuberant crowd. Screamer rockets banged up from the upper arches and fizzled into showers of green and white sparks. 20 meters above the street on the main façade hung a massive wire-on sign that flashed out the name Carnivora in letters 3 times the height of a man. The orange light tubes blinked out the word whole, then pulsed it in syllables. Car-ni-vor-ra, before blazing out the whole again. Caged fires and glow-globes lit up the stadium's exterior columns, and blue-white electric discharge danced up and down cathode filaments over the horseshoe arches of the public turnstiles. Factory-grade hooters sounded above the roar of the crowd, and speakers blasted out the bass-beat hook of a popular pound number at inhuman decibels. In time to the music beat, even louder, the vox horns played a recording of a male voice bellowing, "Ka-ka-carnivora!" Above the wire-on sign, pulsing in time to it, and the beat, and the voice, a massive picked screen projected a loop of fast-edit images. There was a split second of a naked woman, body-painted gold, turning an aerial cartwheel that smash-cut to a fragment of 2 armored male fighters clashing chainswords. The screen smash-cut again to a violent half-second of some lidless, yellow-toothed saurian lunging at the camera, followed by a final smash-cut to a bloody, blurry decapitation that segued to white noise picked out as if the camera had broken. Bang, 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 ka-ka-carnivora, ka-ka-carnivora, over and over and over until the assaulting repetition was one numbing adrenal rush. Patience Kiss let the crowd crush sweep her along to Public Gate 4. She was gnawing on a meat stick she'd bought from a ramp vendor and openly drinking from a liquor flask. She laughed and joked and flirted with the moody hammers and indentureds in the crowd around her, posing with some and gently dissuading the over-eager advances of others with subtle tweaks of telekinesis. In her tight black and emerald bodice and long net-lace skirts, and with her hair loose, she was just another smile girl out to shout herself hoarse and drink herself blind at circus night. Already she was in with a group, a bunch of tanked-up clansters from the meatpack sept. They were big men, noisy, filthy, their vat-muscled bodies rippling with studs and piercings and the distinctive acid tats of their clan. One of them, Lesh, kept passing her his grain liquor for a swig, and he insisted on paying for her at the turnstile. He thought he was in. His brothers certainly believed Lesh had pulled a high formal party girl who was slumming it in the sinks of G for the night. The hammer's hands were all over her, and she let him, up to a point. They flocked en masse through the gate, pressing forward past the stadium stewards towards the wooden stalls in the attic levels, the cheap seats. There was a weapons check at the entrance to the attic levels. The stewards let the hammers through anyway. They knew better than to question the drunken, rowdy clansters with that many piercings. But the doorway flashed red as Kiss went through. The stewards closed on her, despite the protesting roars from Lesh's group.
"I got no blades," Kiss said, straight-faced.
"Shush, you,"
she added to Lesh with a wicked grin. She raised her arms high as the stewards aimed hand scanners at her body, deliberately accentuating the corseting of her top, her pinched waist and elevated bosom.
"See? It's just the wiring in my bodice."
The hammers roared approval. Realizing they were onto nothing, the stewards waved her on. She laughed as she ran through, and Lesh grabbed her around the waist. She kissed him as they rambled up into the attic stalls and found a row with a good view over the primary stage. The circus was filling up. Searchlights swept back and forth across the terraces, illuminating a raving mass of the populace. The pre-game show was just getting underway. The main arena filled the bottom of the stadium's bowl. It was an oval measuring 50 by 90 meters, and it was surrounded on all sides by the rising terraces of public seating. It was not a single showground, but resembled rather the oblate cylinder of a revolver. There were 6 circular cavities around the edge of the oval arena, and 1 large one in the middle. Massive hydraulic systems deep underground could raise or lower performance stages, logiums into place in any of the cavities. The central one was for the night's headline fight. Right now, 3 of the outer logiums were hissing up into place, venting steam through their exhaust outlets. On 2 of them, 20 paired teams of knife fighters with silver fish-head helmets were putting on a display of speed blade work with hair's-breadth accuracy. The crowd gasped. Knives in each hand, whirling like windmill vanes, sparks sliding off meeting blades. Not a single scratch. On the 3rd outer stage, 4 twist clowns were pantomime fighting with mallets. They were all big, lumbering mutants, hunchbacked and ogreish, their disfigurements accented by white face paint, rouged mouths and striped pantaloons. The audience loved them. The whole arena rotated so that everyone could get a decent view of the outer stages. The outstage displays continued as more siren fanfares sounded. A huge scaffold cage descended over the main logium, winched down from the massive lighting gantries and overstage platforms above the arena. The acrobats dropped down into the cage space like coins into a collecting box, free-falling for heart-stopping distances before grabbing crossbeams and trapeze struts. They were all female, naked, painted gold. A mighty applause rang out across the stadium as they swung, caught, pulled fullins and struellies, walked over flat bars, spun on wires, somersaulting and flipping. There was no net. The hard arena was 30 meters below the bottom spars of the performance cage. Lesh slavered at the sight of the nubile gymnasts. He took a tug on his bottle and looked round to pass it to the girl. But Kiss had vanished. Ka, ka, carnivora, ka, ka, carnivora.
You're late,
Mamselle Scissors squalled. Her voice was high-pitched and imperious, as befitted the circus's troupe mistress. She pulled up the hem of her long lace skirts and petticoats and stomped across the suspended boarding with her walking cane. It was twilight up here, under the stadium roof and amongst the lighting gantries. The swell of the crowd's roar came up from 70 meters beneath. Gantrymen ran back and forth, hauling tension wires and adding sand-sack counterweights to the pulley systems. Reflected lights speared back up through the board cracks in the staging under their feet. Kara Swole, wearing a flesh-tight body glove so transparent she might as well have been nude, was smearing the last squeeze of a tube of gold dye over herself.
"I'm sorry, Mamselle," she said. "Sorry doesn't bring in the punters. Sorry doesn't put on a show. I know, Mademoiselle."
Scissors peered at her, her ancient lined face taut and inquisitive.
"Do I know you?"
"Yes, ma'am. I'm Kara, ma'am. You hired me last week."
"Last week? I don't remember."
"You did, ma'am."
"I doubt it. You're not right. Too short. Too much bust and hips."
Scissors poked a gnarled finger into the giving softness of Kara's left breast.
"But you did, ma'am. You thought my handspring and diamond combo was particularly fine, and you liked my wire work."
Mamselle Scissors stepped back, her withered hands folded over the knob of her cane.
"Show me the move again."
Kara breathed in and lunged into a handspring that she flicked out of, spun a body-length flyaway in the air, and came down, stuck. The gantry boarding shuddered under the impact and swung very slightly. Below, the crowd roared again, but not at her. They were out of sight up here.
"Good,"
muttered Mamselle Scissors.
"Where did you learn that?"
"The Imperial Pits, Bonaventure," said Kara.
"I still don't remember hiring you,"
Scissors went on.
"And you are late for the pre-show anyway. I won't have that from my girls. You're sacked."
Kara shrugged. She'd got this far into the circus by passing as one of the acrobat troupe. It was enough. Frankly, she'd got herself up onto the gantry late, deliberately. She hadn't fancied risking her neck in the overhung cage. Once, maybe, she could talk and pass as a dancecrobat, but perhaps these days the exertions of the lissom girls spinning below was a bit beyond her. Still in the part, she frowned.
Sect?
The mamselle thumped her cane on the boarding.
Sect! You heard me. Get dressed and get out.
Kara walked over to where she'd left her belongings and gathered up her clothes.
Go home,
Mamselle Scissors screeched. Kara picked up her kit bag, palmed the compact autogun into her left hand, and headed for the ladders. She was in now. That's all that mattered.
Ka, ka, carnivora, ka, ka, carnivora,
came the roar from below. Harlan Nail leaned on the horn of the freight rig as he edged it down the concrete slip towards the service ramp. The crowd parted slowly to let his ten-wheeler through. Every few seconds, the crossing stabs of the searchlights blinded him and lit up the drive cab blood red. He adjusted his micro-bead.
"Coming up on it now," he whispered. "This better go good."
"Relax, Harlan. Piece of piss," Carl Thonius crackled back.
The shutter ahead was locked down. Stadium officials headed towards him up the ramp, pointing flashlights. They had to push their way through huddles of ecclesiarchy Puritans, protesting against the barbarity of the circus.
"Now, Thonius."
Nail wound his cab window down as the stewards waved at him.
"What's this?"
yelled one.
"Meat truck for the Spoliarum, sir."
"Yeah, what outfit?"
"Buckenold's Bushmeat, sir."
"Let's see the slate,"
the steward said, holding up a hand. Nail handed out the data slate.
"Thonius,"
he hissed into the bead.
"Scanning now,"
Carl Thonius said, sitting back from his cogitator.
5 points, 3 points, 1 point. We're up. I'm reading the guy's slate coding now. Decoding. Decoding.
"Hurry the frig up,"
Nail's voice rasped. "Got it.
Code's clean. Feeding it through to your slate."
"Something wrong?"
Nail asked, peering out of the cab.
"No," said the steward. "No, nothing. A slight registration delay."
He handed the slate back to Nail.
"You check out. Go through, bay number 15. Over the gate. Vehicle coming."
The shutter clanked up into the arch. Nail gunned the engine and rolled the freight rig down into the stadium's coragium. He could feel the thumping handclap and bellowing of the audience above his head.
"Too close, Carl. Too close,"
Nail whispered.
"Was it too close?"
Ravenna asked. In the back of the Cargo 8, Thonius glanced round nervously from the cogitator at his master. Space was cramped. Between the cogitator setup and Ravenna's stowed force chair, there was barely room for the interrogator to sit. Frauke and Zale were exiled up front in the dingy cab. The boy was looking back at them through the chipped clearplex divider. Thonius decided he didn't like the boy. His eyes seemed to be everywhere. Thonius didn't like that at all.
"Was it too close?"
Ravenna asked again.
"No, no," smiled Thonius. "This is non-wired hacking. I had to wait until Nail's slate was close to the stewards so I could get clean reception."
"And he's in?"
"They're all in, sir," Thonius said.
He looked at the sleek casing of Ravenna's force chair. "You're wondering if I'm all right, aren't you?" Ravenna said. Thonius jumped.
"I thought Frauke was switched on,"
he declared.
"How could you read me like—"
"Frauke is switched on," the Inquisitor's voxbonder said expressionlessly. "But I have eyes, and can read body language. You keep looking at me, Carl." Thonius shrugged.
"That thing with Bogosian, it wasn't good."
"No, it wasn't. It hurt. I was unwise, and it scarred me. I'm recovering fine."
"But—"
"But nothing, Carl. I probed an insane mind, and almost got caught in it as it collapsed. But I got out. 3 days have passed. I'm healing." Thonius shrugged. He hadn't been there, But Kiss had told him how Odyssey Bogosian had gone into spasm, and then, well, exploded. Messily, she'd said, as if there was any other way. Kiss said Ravenna had howled as he struggled free of the collapsing mind. A voxponder shriek. A sound she'd never forget. Monotone. Anguished.
Fine, Thonius said. That's good.
He paused and adjusted the wavelength setting of the voxcaster.
Getting signals? Kiss is in. Kara too. Nail is still mobile.
Let's get on with this, Ravenna said.
Ka, ka, carnivora.
The booming declamation came from above her, shaking the walls. The audience was joining in, stamping their feet and clapping in time. Bam, bam, thump. Bam, bam, thump. Patients hurried along the dim stone passageways under the seating, watching the glow globes twitch as the walls vibrated. As she ran, she unfastened her skirts and let them fall, revealing the tight black and emerald bodice to be the top part of a body glove. Now she could move more freely. She adjusted her microbead headset and pulled on her gloves. Someone was coming. She sidestepped into the shadows of an alcove. Two stewards ran past, on urgent business. Up ahead was the hatch entrance to the Caragium. A short but heavy-set twist with horns sprouting from his mottled flesh was watching the hatch. Kiss slid back against the wall and crept towards him. She picked out a broken bottle on the floor of the passageway and, with a gentle sigh, caused it to skitter and tinkle away from her, past the twist and past the hatch. The mutant heard it and turned. His thick grey fingers raised the power ball that had been leaning against the wall next to him, and he bent down, searching for the source of the noise. As soon as his back was turned, Kiss danced forward and slipped away through the hatch, flying down the wide metal stairs into the vast understage chambers of the Carnivora. There was no time to get dressed. Kara dumped her clothes and kit on the landing platform of the ladder climbs and continued on down, a gold phantom with a gun in its hand. The sound coming up at her from the arena below was like a physical force, a beating, deafening, solid thing that made the wire-supported ladder climbs sway. Lights were strobing. She looked down. 30 meters below her and to her left, the stab lights were illuminating the main show stages as the dance acrobats finished their amazing performance and slid down glide ropes to the central logium. That stage disc was already beginning to descend into the underfloor, and outer logiums were rising to present the next entertainment. A roped saurian and 5 drug-numbed twist clowns. She looked away as the biped saurian, maddened by goads and skin-implant agonizers, scored an early point, tearing one of the bemused clowns in two. The crowd, now 250,000 strong, bellowed their appreciation. The ladder climb shook. The whole arena shook. It was a predator roar, the exultation of a blood-hungry mob. The ladder climb wobbled. Gantrymen were coming up from below to help the overhead crews winch back the dance cage. Kara looked left and right, made a quick estimation, and leapt off the landing platform, her weapon gripped between her teeth. She fell 5 meters and caught one of the guy wires with both hands. The snap made her grunt. She accelerated her pendulum swing and then got her legs up over the wire and slid down it. Quite a show, if the lights had been on her. But she was out in the dark, above the radiance of the lamps. A few meters from the end of the wire, she let go and dropped into space. She turned a neat cartwheel and smacked down onto the landing of another ladder climb. She took the gun out of her mouth and wiped her lips, tasting gold body paint. The western terrace was 10 meters below her, a mass of writhing bodies and waving arms. She unwound a support rope from the landing's bracket and tested it for give. Then she kicked out and swung from the landing across to the roof spars of the attic tiers. The swing wasn't quite going to do it. She let go and flip-flopped the last few meters, landing on a rafter barely 30 centimeters wide. Kara teetered on her feet for a moment, arms spread. Then she ran along the rafter and jumped off, dropping onto a crosswise beam 2 meters below. When she reached the end of it, she vaulted over a stone divider and landed in a service gallery above the attics. 2 clansters looked round in surprise as she flew in and landed with a slap. They had left their seats for the cool gloom of the upper walk to share some grin and lax out before the main show. They could scarcely believe their eyes. A voluptuous girl, painted head to foot gold and, as far as they were concerned, butt naked, had just flown in through the frigging window.
"The circus gets better and better," mumbled one.
They stepped towards her. Kara was suddenly glad of the cacophony from below. Nail rolled the freighter to a halt, expressed the air brakes, and pulled on the parking lock. The chamber was like a cavern, dark and damp. Five other trucks were parked beside his. The noise of the circus audience was like remote thunder overhead. This was the Coragium, the understage. For all its size, the circus had more private parts than public ones. Immense cellars and subdecks existed to service the arena. Nail could hear the hissing clank of the rising and falling Logium platforms as he got out of the cab. The air smelled bad. He could taste the ash burn of the Ustrinum, where they cremated the bodies and waste products from the pit fights. Nail walked the length of his freighter and hammered on the backdrop. The tailgate slammed open, and Mathewin leapt out. He was carrying a pistol, but Nail knew the murderous rotator cannon was zipped up in Mathewin's kit bag.
"Put it away,"
he said, nodding at the pistol.
"We've a way to go yet, without attracting notice."
Zeph Mathewin frowned and put the handgun into the pocket of the filthy plastic smock coat he was wearing. Nail had one on too, crusted with dirt and dry blood. They hurried across the chamber, through the bustle of the stewards and crewmen. The floor shook with the transmitted shudder of the crowd. They stood back as three Carve handlers led a muzzled, thrashing Ursid through to the stage gates, ready for the next show. Nail found the chained beast's angry whimpers strangely affecting. He felt sorry for it. Win or lose, it would be bushmeat by dawn. They crossed a stone pier over a rancid waste sluice and passed under a heavy portcullis gate into a warren of understage tunnels. There was activity all around. Stage men shouted for cues. Labour muscle wound the chain winches. Engineers ran coke carts to stoke the furnaces of the hydraulic engines, and gladiators oiled their bodies in the chrismatories. They came down another narrow stone corridor into a wide underfloor hall. The spoliarum was to the left, a dank, fetid pit where all the bodies were dumped. Mechanized ploughs swept each descending logium clean of debris and cadavers, and they ended up in the spoliarum. There, the dead were recycled. Armor and weapons were recovered, and rings and trinkets looted. Human bodies were carted away to the Ustrinum for burning. Non-human flesh was sold off by the kilo to buyers from the food markets. Bushmeat was a cheap and ready source for the hive's provisioners. Bear, lizard, twist, it all looked and tasted the same once it was macerated, spiced, and roasted on a street vendor's stick. A few other meat brokers had arrived before them and were lounging around, smoking, waiting, under an arch nearby. Nail wandered across to the spoliarum overseer and signed his name in exchange for a numbered paper chit. At the end of the show, the overseer would draw the numbers randomly. The winning broker got first pick of the spoils, the second got to choose from what was left, and so on. A butcher's lottery. The waiting brokers had buckets and carts, soiled aprons, saws, and surgical masks. In their filthy plastic smock coats, Nail and Mathewin looked the part.
"Lucky seven," said Nail, walking back to Mathewin and flashing the chit. "What now?"
Mathewin asked.
"Now we lose ourselves in the mix. Hang on."
He strolled over to the waiting brokers and nodded a few curt hellos. Mathewin heard him ask them where a man could get a drink while he waited. A couple of the brokers pointed and mumbled. Nail rejoined Mathewin.
"Now they won't even miss us,"
he said as they fell into step. The underhall was packed. They had to weave their way through the crowd. A team of chainsword fighters shared a group huddle as they waited to enter the caged walkway onto one of the lowered logiums. Weaponeers trundled carts of swords and pikes over to the traps. A pit bull cracked his lash across the backs of a chain gang of convict fighters, desperate men hoping to win a state pardon through an arena victory. Rumor had it the Lord Governor himself was here tonight, enjoying the show from his executive belvedere. That would certainly explain the number of marshals on the prowl. Gold-painted dancers ran by, perspiring and swearing. Two trainers were having a stand-up row about marquee billing. A professional gladiator, huge, oiled and armoured, knelt and bowed his head as the circus's appointed priest blessed him in expectation of death. Tipsters and bookies were everywhere, eyeing up form and gathering last-minute advice for their clients. Servitors lumbered past with crates of water and ale for the fighter pens. Musician bands tuned up against the constant din. Money changed hands. Debts spiraled or were wiped clean. Letters of pledge were signed. Medicaid surgeons knelt in a pool of blood around a twist clown who had come off stage minus an arm. Two animal handlers hurried past with long pole goads. They were heading through the crowds towards a heavy shutter on the far side of the hall.
"Follow them," said Nail.
The galley halls were rattling with activity. In a hellish, smoky environment, squads of cooks and their underlings and servitors slaved to cater for the paying customers in the stadium. Most of their fare was savouries or pies that were taken up by Boxlift, the vendor stalls in the stands, but there were sumptuous feasts to be prepared for the dignitaries in the exclusive belvederes, meals that would be shipped up by hand and served by impeccably mannered attendants in circus livery. Kiss held back in the main doorway for a second. Unless she went all the way around the outside underwalks of the circus-drome, the only way to the cave was through the galleys. And no matter how many telekinesis distractions she created, she'd not manage that without being seen. She breathed in, remembering one of the Inquisitor's training dictums. If you can't hide, don't. Bluster. If nothing else, Patience Kiss had boundless confidence. She adjusted her microbead and whispered,
"Carl, who's head chef tonight?"
As the reply came, she straightened her bodice demurely, adopted a haughty stance, and marched into the kitchens. A few under-chefs glanced at her, perplexed, but they were too fearful of their head cooks to stop what they were doing and challenge her. Kiss strode right down the line between brushed steel workstations and paused to lift the lid on a large stockpot simmering over a galley range.
"Who the hell are you?"
yelled a senior cook, spotting her. He was a fat man, always a good sign in a cook, Kiss believed. But he was meatily powerful and over 2 spans tall. His apron was cinched around his great girth. Red-faced, he marched over to her, pushing several slow-moving undercooks out of his path. Kiss ignored him. She elegantly extended the index finger of her gloved left hand and stuck the tip of it into the pot's contents. Then she withdrew it and made a business of studying the moonstone ring she wore on it.
"I said—"
"I heard," she cut him off, and looked him in the eye. "Are you binders?"
"What?"
"Binders, man. Binders. Are you binders? I was told he was cook in charge tonight."
The senior backed off a little.
"No, ma'am. I'm Kachetska. Senior binders is away in the cold store. But I can get him if—"
"No matter, Kachetska. Your name was mentioned, too. I've heard fine things of your work. Fine things."
The senior blushed.
"Mum."
Kiss walked past him to another range where underlings were pan-frying marinated terrapins.
"You understand that not just anything can pass the Lord Governor's lips?"
Kachetska balked.
"The Lord Go—"
"His food must be inspected rigorously for tampering."
I know that, ma'am,"
the senior exclaimed, hurrying after her.
"But his tasters and personal dietitian have already examined the kitchen and—"
"I know they have. But an unscheduled inspection keeps you on your toes, does it not?"
Kiss leaned past an undercooked shoulder and pressed the tip of her left index finger against the tenderized belly of a frying terrapin. Then she studied her ring again. As if noticing the way Senior Kachetska was staring at her hand, she held it up towards him.
"Augmatic," she said. "The index finger is a micro-calibrated poison snooper. If it detects any trace venoms, the result is displayed in the ring screen."
"I see,"
nodded Kachetska. Kiss raised a little finger on her left hand.
"This digit cases a tight-focused digi-weapon. If I find any food tampering, I am authorized to use it to incinerate the line chef responsible for the contaminated area."
Kachetska started to tremble.
"I can assure you—"
"I'm sure you can. Walk me through.
Kiss started off again, with Kachetska hurrying to catch up. She paused for a moment to glance back at the undercook frying the terrapins.
Too much nutmeg, by the way.
Kachetska took her down the line, waiting nervously while she poked her finger into all kinds of food. He brought her a glass of wine, and she poked her finger into that too, before nodding and knocking it back. He introduced her to four other seniors, who fell in step behind them, like an anxious chorus. Finally, she turned to face Kachetska.
"Through there,"
she said, indicating over her shoulder with a thumb.
"That goes through into the cave, am I right?"
"Indeed, ma'am."
"I'm very troubled. Livestock, including Xenos breeds, penned this close to the main food manufactory."
"We are scrupulously clean, ma'am,"
Kachetska began.
"My dear senior, Xenos germs and bacteria travel in ways unknown to science. I will have to examine it."
Kiss took off one of her pearl earrings and handed it to Kachetska.
"Hold that up, please, between finger and thumb. No, arm straight. Higher. That's it."
She started to walk away.
"What am I doing?" he called.
"That's a relay sensor for my augmetics," she said. "I'll enter the cave and take readings, and then compare them to the delayed response of that module. Be careful. It's very delicate. Arm straight, please. This should only take about 10 minutes. You can stand there for 10 minutes holding that up in the air, can't you, senior?"
"Of course, ma'am."
"Good. Arm really straight, please. Do try not to move."
The knuckles on her right hand were badly skinned. Threads of blood ran down the back of her hand and along the gold-painted skin of her forearm. The second clanster's jaw had been more solid than it looked. Laying them out had slowed her down. Kara was running now, along the attic upper walk, and then down the stone screw stair, the emergency exit that led right down the side of the building into the subdecks. She took them three at a time, hip-surfing off the handrails and leaving streaks of gold paint behind. The stadium was still shaking with noise. Through a window slit, she glimpsed the night's first headline bout, beginning on the main logium. The outer stages had sunk down into their pits, awash with gore and littered with bodies, victorious champions raising their arms and bloodied blades to the baying masses as they descended from view. To a fanfare and a tumult,
ka, ka, carnivora,
bam, bam, thump. The evening's first primary spectacle rose up on the central stage. Chained at intervals around the main stage's edges were four professional pit fighters, armed and gleaming, and four inhumanly massive greenskins, glanded out of their minds on spiker and slavering at their leashes. A thornbar cage rose up to surround the main logium. Then the chains released. The crowd roared, louder than ever before. Kara kept on running. She came down into a Coragium subdeck, where sooty spade workers were shoveling body parts into the furnace hatches of the Ustrinum, and sprinted west, through the tunnels of the fighter pens, towards the cave. A pair of stewards at the entrance tried to stop her.
"Where are you off to in a hurry, dancer girl?" asked one.
"Not that we mind you running at all," smiled the other. "Makes your body jiggle real nice, if you know what I mean."
No time left. Certainly no time for subtlety.
"My frigging boyfriend just got eaten by some frigging carnosaur,"
Kara yelled.
"I gotta get in there."
"If he's eaten," one of the stewards began.
"He had my nanny's diamond ring as a keepsake. I gotta check the dung for it, or nanny'll kill me."
There was no arguing with that. They let her pass.
"Huh, some keepsake,"
one of the stewards called after her.
Ranklin Sesmi Dubow, accredited handlerman chief of the Imperial Pits, ran the cave. He was 200 years old, standard, and had benefited from judicious juvenile work. He looked 45, was strong and well-muscled. His grizzled face sported a bushy salt-and-pepper moustache. He never seemed to have to raise his voice. Just a look sent his handlers scurrying. He was a force of power in the circus understage. Without his say-so and his skill, the show would simply not go on. He knew what to buy and where to buy it. He knew how to source the most interesting and deadly beasts for the show, and how to cage them and keep them fit, and how to get them dandered up just right for the spectacle.
Of all the great understage sections of the circus stadium, the cave smelled the worst. Worse than the kitchens, worse than the fight waste furnaces, worse even than the reeking spoliarum. In a long semicircular series of dank chambers under the drome's western end, the pit animals were caged and prepped. The air was wretched with the sharp bite of piss ammonia and fecal matter. Blood, too, and the humid, musky scents of penned creatures, most of them predators, most of them anguished and goaded. A queue man ran a slip over to Dubow. He read it, tossed it away, checked with the logium control via his headset, and then pointed across the paved stone floor to a team of handlers around a trap cage in which a mature fighting struthid was clawing and clacking. The handlers obeyed at once. They pulled the slot hatch open. They pulled the slot hatch open on the logium entry and then cranked back the cage door. The flightless fighting bird, 4 meters tall and with a beak the size of a space marine's power axe, came rushing out up the penway, driven by the sparking jolts of the handler's electro-goads. Overhead, the crowd thundered approval. Pulling off his headset, Dubow walked over to the group of game agents assembled around an upturned pack crate they were using as a table. A smile girl in a short skirt had fetched them liquor and grin from upstairs, at Dubow's expense. She was serving them now. Dubow approached and shook hands with a few of them, accepting a shot glass of Amasek from the girl.
Budrus, good work that struthed. Worth the wait, I'm sure.
Budrus, a sallow man with 2 lean bodyguards, nodded his satisfaction.
Skull, what can I say?
Dubow slapped hands with a heavy-set, square-jawed man with sandy white hair. Skull's bulky figure was sleeved in leather armor.
Perfect Saurians, as always. I may have some long tusks come winter, said Skull. Interested? Only if they're the aggressive kind. The dociles play really bad here.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, Verdandana. I haven't forgotten that crap fest last summer.
A bespectacled agent turned his head, miffed.
I was assured of their quality,
he began querulously.
Take another drink, Verdandana. Dubow smiled. You've redeemed yourself with those ursids. Never seen bears so nasty. Leave the long tusks to Sko here.
Sko nodded appreciatively. Dubow looked over at another game agent.
Murphy, stop bringing me shit crocodilians, or I'll turn them back.
Murphy hung his head.
Sorry, Dubow. They seem class to me.
They weren't class. They were shit. Doped.
I had to dope them to get him in transit.
Next time, load them with a spike to get them kicking. Those bastards just lay there in the friggin' pool, like it was midsummer with nothing to do.
Sorry, Dubow.
Dubow finished his drink and set the glass down.
That's all for tonight, gentlemen. I've work to do. Pick up your fees from the drone office. I've stamped your dockets. Get on with you.
The group broke up. Dubow tugged Sko by the arm and drew him aside.
Post-match, we'll talk. I've got demand. Can you deal?
I'll talk to Captain Thekla, Sko said.
Ka, ka, carnivora.
The main stage slid down out of sight. An outer rim logium rose with 2 raptors from Quinns on it, slavering at their chains. In the underpits of the cavia, Harlan Nail walked up behind Dubow and fell in step with him. Dubow was busy shouting out at a team of gangers who were about to let a bullcat out of its cage.
Dubow.
Who are you?
Let's take a walk and talk.
Dubow stopped and looked at Nail. They were eye to eye. Dubow was a big man, and he didn't take shit from anyone.
I don't think so, Dubow said.
And yet, I think so,
said Nail.
There's a Transvasor 50 in my coat pocket, and it's looking at you.
Dubow frowned.
Just a word, and my staff will have you over. Gut you. Feed you to the animals. I don't know who you are, but get out of my friggin' way.
Nail smiled.
You want to go for it? Look to your left. Catwalk. See the big guy? He's watching out for me. That's a rotator cannon. Let's see your staff deal with that.
Dubow shrugged.
So, you're heavyweight. Hardcore.
I'm impressed. What do you want?
Cooperation,
said Nail. Dubow nodded.
Look, mate, if I don't release these signets, the circus master will have my guts. Go ahead.
Dubow aimed a control wand, and frothing dog beasts dashed out of their cage and up the trap towards the stage.
You said cooperation, Dubow said.
Concerning what?
Flects. You deal. I know. I want a source.
Dubow laughed.
Funny?
Asked Nail.
Like I'd tell you. You'd need more than a gun in your pocket to get that out of me. And there I was, being nice,
smiled Nail. I'm sure you were, Dubow said. He looked back at Nail. Ripfish. What do you know about him?
What?
Ripfish.
Are you familiar with them?
Nail frowned.
They're from Antigula. Antigula, right? Like eels, but voracious. Strip a human to bones in a second.
He paused.
Why the frig are you asking me that?
Dubow grinned and raised the control wand.
Because you're the one standing on the trapdoor.
The hatch parted under him, and Harlan Nail fell. Below, the water chute was a frothing madness of famished ripfish, boiling the water to hell. Amid the Carve's din and activity, no one seemed to notice what had happened for a moment. But Methuen had his eyes on Nail and started forward along the catwalk with a cry. Dubow, hurrying on his way, clapped his hands and roared an order. A mob of waiting handlers immediately unlatched a main pen and herded horned grazers out towards the central upramp. They were big, jittering beasts, designed to be the third-party distraction in a large-scale man-stroke predator show fight. Methuen cursed. Surging forward, the grazers suddenly created a flowing wall of haunches, bellies, and hooves between him and Dubow. He ran along the catwalk further to where suspended steps gave him access to a higher walkway.
Dubow's running, he voxed as he moved. Dubow's running and Nail's down.
Dubow himself moved quickly across the main floor space of the handling chamber. He was talking fast into his headset, making it look like business as usual, but in fact he was calling in his inner circle. Already three or four veteran handlers were heading after Methuen. Two others were heading across the understage to check the ripfish had done their job and to close the tank shutters. The pair of them approached the deck hatch and heard the wet thrashing from below. One of them went towards the winch post that manually controlled the hatch. Upright, a slightly surprised look on his face, and his hands at his sides, as if to keep balance, Nail rose up out of the tank pit, suspended on empty air. He wasn't even wet. Dubow's goons blinked at him. Nail landed on his feet, gently, on the edge of the tank in front of them.
"Where did Dubow go?"
he said, as if nothing untoward had happened. Scared more than anything else, the goons drew out short-bladed estocks and lunged at him. Nail delivered a backhand slap across the face of one, whose headlong charge became a disorientated backward stagger. Then he sidestepped the other. The second man was only wrong-footed for a moment. He turned to come in at Nail again. But he cried out in alarm. Although his feet had stopped moving and he was wheeling his body around, he was continuing to surge forward. His feet dragged and pumped weightlessly on the pit edge, and then he was suspended out over the tank itself, held in space by some soft, invisible force. A force that went away again as suddenly as it had come. With a shriek, he dropped out of sight. The other goon rallied at Nail, who grabbed his knife hand, snapped the wrist, and punched him so hard in the face that he fell down and didn't get up again.
Thanks, Nail said. I thought it was fish bait there.
Kiss walked into view, breathing hard.
Sorry it was a bit last minute. You've put on weight.
Together they started to run across the chamber. Many of the handlers and pit crews had seen the brief, violent altercation and had stopped work, glancing around in confusion. Some were calling out for Dubow.
To the left, that way, said Kiss,
running ahead of Nail. Pit men got out of their way in a hurry.
Methuen,
Nail voxed.
Busy,
the link answered. Methuen was up on the higher catwalk by then. Dubow's hefty teamsters, a couple of them twists, were coming up ladders at either end. The bounty hunter slid to a halt, looked up and down the walkway, and then swung the cradle brace around so the cannon's multi-barrels covered the west end of the walk. Two men ran up into view. One had a drawn stub pistol.
"Drop it!" he shouted. "You're kidding, right?"
Mathewin replied. He tipped up the barrels with a slight tug and fired off a blurt. The sound of it boomed across the chamber. Hypervelocity shots howled over the heads of the two men in front of him. The one with the stub pistol fell down the steps in an effort to duck and knocked the man behind him off the stepway entirely. Falling, the man tried to grab a suspension strut, but missed and landed badly on a cage roof below. The small biped saurians in the cage began to leap and snap up at him. The man struggled to balance on the curved roof bars and yelled out for help. The sound of Mathewin's cannon had caused other trouble. There was genuine panic in the cave now. The penned animals began struggling against their cages. Several others in the process of being moved, including a spiger and the grazers Dubow had signaled, went berserk and broke free. The spiger, a 3-meter-long felid form with 8 legs and a furred segmented body, snapped its leads, brought a servitor crashing over, and started to chase pitmen across the floor. The grazers stampeded in all directions, crashing into cages, into chute walls, into guardrails, into crates and barrels, into men. 6 of them, in a tight galloping pack, broke all the way round the saurian lockers and trampled 2 handlers on the loading ramp behind them. The grazers had big, V-shaped horns growing up from thick bone masses above their flaring nostrils, and when they ran, they put their heads down. There were marrow-mashing crunches. A body was tossed up into the air, terribly gored, and came down on the locker roofs. It lay there, leaking blood through the bars and driving the caged saurians into a frenzy. More handlers ran in, firing scatterguns and cracking lashes. Other workers fled for the exits. From his vantage point, Mathewin glimpsed Dubow running through the pandemonium towards the northern cargo docks. He voxed the sighting to the others, then ducked shots at him from behind. Several pitmen, firing small arms, were rushing along the walkway after him. Mathewin turned and felt the rotator cannon shudder against his hip. White flame danced around the muzzles. His pursuers pulverized explosively in puffs of blood and meat, and several shots tore into the catwalk itself, shredding the decking and shearing support cables. A whole section of catwalk tore away and plunged 20 meters to the floor below. Mathewin turned grimly to continue on his way when something of extraordinary force struck him on the left shoulder and wrenched him off his feet. He spun off the walkway and into the air. He blacked out for a microsecond, then woke in time to black out again when he smashed face first into a cage roof. 50 meters away, across the cave's crowded, chaotic floor space, the game agent, Sko, lowered his custom-made longlas.
"Thank you," said Dubow. "Now come on."
"This is my neck on the block here too, Dubow. Who are these people?"
Dubow smiled at the game agent, pushing pitmen out of his path.
"They're dead," he said.
Mathewin woke with a start. Before he had even tried to remember where he was, he knew he was hurt bad. Broken ribs, seriously frigged arm and shoulder. He was face down, suspended across the bars of a cage roof. His head, right leg, right forearm, and the business end of the rotator cannon were all hanging limply down through the iron rungs. He tried to move, but it seemed too painful, and the bars were so widely spaced that if he rolled too far, he might well slip down between them entirely. Slowly, he raised his right hand to clasp the nearest rung, then his right leg, hooking his foot around a rung for support. Then he tried to raise his head. Pain made him close his eyes. Whiplash, maybe, from the fall, combined with the damage the las load had done punching through his shoulder. For a second, Mathewin felt hot, damp, stinking air blow up at his face, and wet droplets spatter him. There was a sound like 2 heavy wooden boards being smacked together. He opened his eyes. 4 meters below, the cage's occupant, a mature crocodilian, looked up at him with lidless yellow eyes. It lunged vertically again, its great maw wide open, and, pain be damned, this time Mathewin pulled his head up. Another hot blast of breath and saliva, another hollow smack as the jaws closed empty. The thing slithered round beneath him. He pulsed the trigger of the cannon to rake it to pieces, but got nothing except the pinging misfire tone. The fall had screwed the cannon, jarring the munition feed out of its lock. The crocodilian powered up again, driving itself against the cage floor with its massive tail. This time it got him. The tip of the massive jaws closed around the dangling end of the cannon barrels.
"Oh, shit!"
Mathewin gasped as the gigantic weight began to pull the cannon down between the bars, and him with it. For a moment, across the heads of the milling crowd, Nail saw Dubow. Then he was gone again, and trouble was rushing Nail and Kiss from all sides. Pitmen and Twists, paid well to be loyal, piled in with fists and blades and goad staves. Nail was in no mood now. With a snarl, he lashed into the first one, crushing a nasal bone, and chopped an elbow elsewhere into a throat. An electroprod stung him a glancing blow on the right hip, but the armor of his body glove soaked the worst, so he tore the prod out of the man's hands and stung him back into the air with it. Then he brought the crackling prod round one-handed, like a saber, and felled the next.
"Patience!"
"Right with you,"
she said, making her words audible over the commotion by way of a little T-nudge boost. Two pitmen were already on their hands and knees at her feet, coughing blood. She straight-armed the heel of her left hand into the solar plexus of a third, catching the barbed pole the man dropped with a little telekinesis, and then spinning the pole straight into the face of another. A twist with a cleaver swung for her, but she did a nimble 360 walkover to get out of his way, and then TK'd the floating pole round in a fast circle and cracked the twist around the back of the skull with it. Kiss stepped forward over the twist and drew four kine blades that had been concealed as boning in her bodice. The four sharp slivers began to orbit in slow circuits around her. Nail tossed aside the now buckled electroprod and tackled another handler using an arm lock and pushed the yowling man out of their way. Dubow had already disappeared through the shutters into the northern cargo docks. Raw agony tore through Mathewin's shoulder and neck. The crocodilian was beginning to shake its snout. He couldn't reach around far enough with his right hand to release the cannon's harness straps. He felt himself beginning to slide.
"Help me,"
he gasped.
"Get out of here,"
Dubow told Sko as they crossed the cargo dock. Sko had just used his long lads to cut down a maddened grazer that was bucking and jerking across the deck.
"I've got things to do. Get out, and I'll meet you at the usual place."
Sko nodded and hastened off towards his truck. Dubow turned and went the other way towards his private offices under the north end terraces. By then, the whole stadium knew something was amiss in the understage. There was a lot of discontented noise from upstairs. A squad of six armored marshals came pounding out of the stair access to his left. Regularly posted at the circus, the officers recognized Dubow at once.
"In there, the cave," Dubow yelled. "Reckon it's some of those friggin' anti-bloodsport maniacs. They're armed, so watch it."
The marshals pumped their shotgun grips and spread out towards the cave hatchways. Dubow reached his office, punched his code into the doorplate, and was felled from behind by a hefty blow. He looked up, dazed. One of the friggin' dance cravats. She was pointing a compact at his face.
"What the hell?"
he growled.
"You're coming with me," she said. "Right now, before this gets any further out of hand."
Dubow grinned.
"Ekrot," he said.
"What?" said Kara. Ekrot was one of the Carnivora's headline gladiators. Something of a local hero in G. 2.5 spans tall, an ex-clanster, formed like a mountain range from grafter muscle, he was blessed, oiled, armored in gold monobond ceramite armor, armed with a chainsword, and loyally in the pay of his friend and dealer, Ranklin Sesmi Dubow. He was also standing right behind Kara Swole. Nail and Kiss came up out of the cave into the dock, and straight into the path of the Magistratum squad. They saw the heavy pistol in Nail's hand and aimed their riot guns and red laser taggers.
"Where you are! Drop the handgun!"
Nail glanced sideways at Kiss. She didn't even break stride. The four kine blades zipped away from their orbit around her and flew into the open barrels of the four nearest pump guns. Two misfired on the spot, blowing their users back hard. A slamming wave of telekinesis and the butt of Nail's pistol left the rest sprawled and disarmed. Nail and Kiss broke into a run. Faced with a choice between keeping her gun or keeping her head, Kara opted for the latter and threw herself into the longest impromptu dive of her life to avoid the gladiator's scything chainsword. She had no time to prep for a decent landing, and the compact bounced out of her hand as she sprawled over and rolled. Ekrot was also fast. She rolled hard and then had to backflip just to evade the singing edge of the sword as he stormed after her, swiping at her. His blade tip cut a groove in the rockcrete floor, then nicked a pillar. Kara ducked and did a handspring sideways, landing neat and next to her fallen compact. She snatched it up and fired off four or five shots. Ekrot's armor and surface muscle stopped them all. The chainsword mangled the muzzle of the compact, and she ditched it, turning a backward somersault as the gladiator closed the distance between them again. Kara was out of breath. Her muscles burned. How much longer could she stay out of the bastard's reach? There was a shot, something chunky like a las carbine, and the crocodilian let go and flopped over onto the cage floor, leaking black ichor from its spilt brain pan. Mathewin sagged as the weight released. His left arm felt like it had been torn out of its socket. He saw the barrels of the rotator were twisted and deformed. He peered around, upside down. Carl Thonius was staring up at him from outside the cage, carbine slung in his hands. "You alive?" he called. Mathewin moaned, nodded, and slid slowly back along the roof bars. Then he flopped over until he hit the ground. When he landed, he just stayed there, too hurt and exhausted to move. Thonius walked up to him. The cave around them was still in uproar.
"You're here,"
panted Mathewin.
"Yeah. Sounded like you needed the whole works."
"So he's here too?"
"Oh, yeah."
Running across the cargo dock, Nail and Kiss saw Kara fighting to stay out of the big pit fighter's way. Any second now, the chain blade was going to unzip her.
"Kara!"
Nail yelled. He was still 15 meters away. He raised his heavy pistol and opened fire, striking the gladiator's back armor several times. Ekrot lurched under the high cal impacts. He wheeled away from Kara, not interested in her anymore, and took another bullet in the cheek guard. He charged Nail and Kiss. Kiss met him with her telekinesis, but he was too massive for her to lift. All she could do was stop him in his tracks for a moment. Ekrot struggled against the invisible barrier, and Kiss wobbled back a step.
"God Emperor!"
she wailed with the effort.
"Drop him, Nail!"
"Trying,"
Nail replied. He'd slapped home a fresh clip and was busy emptying that. The pit fighter was clearly hardwired against pain and hyped up on some serious glanding frenzy maker. Nail was inflicting serious tissue damage to the gladiator's chest, but still he was fighting to reach them, his face a rictus of kill hate.
"Can't hold him,"
Kiss barked. Her telekinesis stalled, exhausted, and Ekrot thundered towards them. Then a huge force lifted the gladiator off his feet and drove him hard against the chamber wall. He continued to thrash. The force, invisible, slammed him into the wall three or four times until the stone facings cracked and he went limp. The Inquisitor's force chair powered towards them across the dock. Frauke, his limiter clearly active, walked behind it. Zale was in tow. Nail pushed on past Kara, who was on her knees panting, and into the handler man's offices. The floor was littered with papers, slates, and other belongings that had been overturned in Dubois' frenzy to cover his tracks. Dubois was behind the desk, a heavy-grade tube charge in his hands. "Uh-uh," he warned, his hand ready to twist the arming dial.
"Back out."
As if alive, the tube charge leapt out of his hands and crunched hard into his nose. Dubois fell on the floor, hands clutched to his bloody face. Kiss stepped up behind Nail and took the charge out of the air where it was floating. Together they bundled him out onto the dock where Ravenna was waiting with Kara, Frauke, and the boy.
"Get him to the transports."
They all started to move, then stopped when they heard the Inquisitor send the word, "Wait!" His mind voice seemed to falter. There was a rush of air. The main dock hatches around the outer edges of the bay were hissing open. Units of Magistratum and PDF troops were streaming in, and amongst them were several men and women dressed in simple grey suits. Two were already heading right towards them. One was a very big man indeed. The other, small and thin, was regarding them with piercing blue eyes. It was the Psyker, Kinski.